From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll look ahead to tomorrow's election day, and pot is on some ballots.
Ballot proposals regarding authorization or prohibition of marijuana businesses. There are 10 communities with these types of proposals.
Do Flint voters trust Mayor Karen Weaver enough to reelect her?
I would say people in Flint just don't trust government anyway.
A new approach to mental health care, an urgent care center.
The urgent care allows people who are having symptoms today to come in and be assessed and get started with treatment if they don't need to experience a higher level of care.
And what are prisons for? We ask Pulitzer Prize winning historian Heather Ann Thompson.
We really need to investigate this whole idea of a life sentence. No country hands out life sentences the way that we do.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Life on the inside, stories from a Michigan prison. Today we kick off our week-long look at Michigan prisons by asking a fundamental question. What is the purpose of prison?
I think that most people think that at some core level, it's about returning people to society better than when they went in. But sometimes the vengeance feeling gets in the way, and we get a very mixed message in the way we run our prisons.
Later in the program, host Lester Graham speaks with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Heather Ann Thompson. But first, there's been a lot of attention paid to Election Day 2020, the presidential race, but we want to focus on tomorrow's elections. For that, we turn to Zach Gorchow of Gongwer. So, Zach, there are no statewide questions on this year's ballot. Certainly, there are some interesting local elections. In just a little bit, we're going to turn to Steve Carmody to talk about the race for mayor in Flint, and certainly in Warren, Mayor Jim Fouts, everybody watching to see if he is reelected. But what about you? What kind of races are you watching most closely, or issues you're watching?
Well, I think probably the first big thing we're going to be watching are ballot proposals regarding authorization or prohibition of marijuana businesses. There are 10 communities with these types of proposals, 6 to authorize marijuana facilities in their jurisdictions, and 4 to prohibit them. There have been a smattering of these so far this year. This is all part of the marijuana legalization proposal that voters passed last year. It said that if enough people in a given jurisdiction wanted to bring a proposal before the ballot to authorize or prohibit marijuana businesses, they could do that. It was sort of seen as a safety valve if perhaps the public didn't agree with the direction of their city council or township board. There have been a few of these so far this year. They've all gone in the direction of against the facilities. But now with 10 questions all at once, there's going to be a lot of attention paid to see whether this is really a viable method to authorize marijuana businesses in a community.
And interesting, just to kind of get a sense of what people are thinking now that recreational marijuana is a reality, should we be expecting to see communities voting on this issue for years to come?
Depending on what happens on Tuesday, if all of these go against the facilities, I think you're going to see probably a sense that this may just not work, that just because a community may have voted in favor of recreational marijuana, and perhaps by large numbers, that there's going to be some hesitation to go forward. Now, having said that, maybe the feeling is, well, we need to try this at a general election in an even-numbered year when there's big turnout, that these lower turnout elections don't work in our favor. So I don't think it would be a total raise the white flag, but I think it would be definitely a damper on that idea.
Let's talk about school bonds. Ann Arbor asking for a huge bond for schools, $1 billion. Dearborn is hoping voters will approve a $245 million school bond. These aren't districts that we typically think of as having a funding problem. What do these asks tell us about the state of school districts and funding in our state?
You have to remember that our main school finance system, established under Proposal A of 1994, only deals with operations. It still leaves matters of infrastructure, meaning the buildings, to the local school district. And look, you know, there's a huge number of buildings that went up in the 50s and 60s, and they're falling apart. They're not in good shape. Ann Arbor, in particular, has some really old buildings, I think date back to the 20s. And so these are really sizable asks. The Ann Arbor one is the largest I'm personally aware of in the years we've been tracking this, though the Detroit Public Schools did have a $1.5 billion bond issue back in 1994, so it's certainly not the largest ever, but it is really big relative to what schools usually do.
Are there other districts we should keep an eye on?
Well, the Dearborn one you mentioned is a big one. You've got some other big ones I'll just sort of tick off here. You've got Novi, $185 million. Huron Valley School District in Southeast Michigan, $182 million. Hudsonville Public Schools on the west side of the state, that's $140 million. Those are all the ones that are, I would describe as really substantial. I would also keep an eye out for something like the Plainwell Community Schools. This is in Allegan County on the west side of the state. It's just shy of $50 million, not as big. But there's been, I would say, maybe some anecdotal evidence that bond issues are doing a little better in suburban and more developed communities than rural communities. In general, bond issues, school bond issues do very well. They tend to pass with anywhere from, each round of elections, 65 to 80% of them tend to pass. But at least this year, there's been some signals that maybe they're a little bit less successful in rural areas. So I'll be keeping an eye on that.
Also noticed on Gongwer that you're reporting on the first significant TV ad buy in Michigan's 2020 U.S. Senate campaign, already looking out ahead a year. What's that buy about?
Well, this is a purchase by an outside organization on the conservative side to attack Senator Peters and, by extension, help his Republican challenger, John James. I think clearly what this says is there's a lot of Republican interest in this race. It's probably a rare opportunity in the cycle for the Republicans to try to play offense. There's still sort of this look that, Trump did carry Michigan in 2016. John James has shown he can raise a lot of money, has a really interesting resume, and, Gary Peters, his name recognition is a little bit soft, as is often the case for a first-term U.S. senator. And I think you're seeing, hey, can we move some numbers around here? Could we maybe get his negatives up with an early purchase and put him under some more pressure?
And this million-dollar ad buy is just the tip of the advertising iceberg in the year to come, that's for sure.
Very much so.
Zach Gorchow, Gongwer News Service. It's always great talking with you, Zach. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
One race to watch tomorrow, mayor of Flint. Incumbent Karen Weaver was chosen Flint's mayor in 2015 during the throes of the water crisis. She promised to clean the water and to restore broken trust in government. This year, she's being challenged by Democratic State Representative Sheldon Neely, who is serving his third and final term in the House. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody is here with us. So, Steve, Mayor Weaver survived a recall vote 2 years ago, and there were just a couple hundred votes between Weaver and Neely in the August primary. What does that tell us about how people in Flint feel about Karen Weaver?
Well, it tells us that Flint remains a very politically divided community between people who are, very supportive of the mayor and a very large faction of the voting population that does not trust either the mayor or the people that she brought to City Hall.
What has the campaign been like? Are people worked up about the race?
The campaign has been relatively low key up until the last few weeks. Mainly, you would see signs in people's yards, but that was really about it. But about 2 to 3 weeks ago, we started seeing Mayor Weaver bringing in high profile supporters like the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Martin Luther King III, and just this past weekend, Greg Mathis, of the star of the Judge Mathis program, to raise the profile of her campaign. And on the other side, Representative Neely, he's been actively working, but at a lower profile level.
But Representative Neely asked the Secretary of State to closely watch Flint's election tomorrow. Why was that?
Back during the August primary, some allegations started coming up that people within the Weaver campaign had been out collecting absentee ballots from people. And there was some question whether all of those ballots made it to the polls, suggesting that possibly they were delivering ballots that supported the mayor, but maybe not ballots that supported one of her opponents. Again, those are allegations at this point. The Weaver campaign says that there's no evidence to support the allegations that have come up, but those allegations have persisted since the August primary.
What kind of response did Representative Neely get from the Secretary of State? Will there be closer monitoring?
As of the time of our conversation right now, I have not heard anything from the Secretary of State to indicate that they will be doing any more closely monitoring of Flint's election.
So what is Karen Weaver's strongest pitch to voters? What successes can she say, look what I've done for you?
Well, as you pointed out, when she came into office, that was at the absolute bottom of Flint's water crisis. And in the 4 years since, the city has seen tens of millions of dollars come in that have helped replace thousands of lead service lines connecting people's homes to city water mains. There's also been a lot of financial investment. Many manufacturing jobs have come into the city. There's now new home construction going on in town. So she can point to progress dealing with the water crisis and also economic development that's happened under her watch.
Do you think people in Flint trust City Hall any more now than under her predecessor, Dane Walling?
Oh, it's one of those things. It's difficult to quantify. I would say people in Flint just don't trust government anyway. You know, whatever progress you could say has been made on the water crisis, the city's water bills are still incredibly high, and that has a negative effect on people in the community and a negative effect on their trust in government. On my way in to the office today, I passed a church with a very long line of cars out in front where people were still picking up cases of bottled water. So while there might be some positive feelings towards the mayor, people generally still don't trust their water and still don't trust City Hall.
What about Representative Neely? What would you say his strongest pitch to voters is?
He has made the water crisis and the city's response to it a major part of his campaign. He's been questioning whether the money that's come in, all of the money that's come in, has gone directly to correcting the problem. And one of the things he's made a major point on is calling for a forensic audit of the city's books to make sure the money has been spent properly. So he's been raising a lot of questions about how the mayor has managed this crisis and has she managed it as well as she claims she has.
And this is the first election, Steve Carmody, after passage of this new state law that lets absentee voting happen without reason. Any sense how that might affect the mayoral race in Flint?
Well, again, the questions that were raised about the absentee ballots back in the August primary is something of a major issue, mainly because we have seen a significant increase in the number of people who've been voting by absentee ballot. We did see that in the August primary. We're seeing more absentee ballots here for the general election. And, you know, we'll see how that all works out. Again, the questions that the anti-Weaver forces have been raising about, you know, who's handling these absentee ballots could become a very important issue if this is a very close vote, which it may very well be.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody. As always, Steve, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And an update. The Secretary of State's office informed the Neely campaign this afternoon it is declining the request for more oversight. The letter suggests sending specific complaints to law enforcement. Coming up, food delivery robots are rolling in Ann Arbor. When will this technology catch on in other towns? We'll find out after the break here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Its name is Rev1, and this little robot would like to bring you food. A startup in Ann Arbor is testing this autonomous food delivery vehicle. Matthew Johnson Robertson is co-founder and CEO of Refraction AI, the company that makes Rev1. He's also a robotics professor at the University of Michigan. Welcome, and tell us just, you know, who or what is Rev1?
Well, thank you so much for having me. We're really excited. Rev1 is a delivery vehicle that's designed to bring food to people's homes. So we pick up food from our restaurant partners, and then we drop it off at people's houses. Ultimately, our goal is to make delivery more efficient, greener, and help with congestion in major cities.
Now, describe it to us, because I want to get people to get a good sense of the size and how it operates.
Yeah, so I think one of the first things that people see and are quite surprised about is kind of how big it is. So it's about the same size as a person on a bike. So when you think of delivery robots, you think of the small sidewalk ones, but this comes up almost to my shoulder. So it's about 4.5 feet tall, about 32 inches wide, so a little bit wider than a bike, but about the same as a bike with a person on it, and it weighs around 100 pounds. And so it's designed to travel at the same speed and sort of at the flow of traffic as a bicycle would. So that means it can be along the side of the road where parked cars are, but chugging along anywhere it's safe to ride a bike. So if it's not safe for you to ride a bike there, we would not take our vehicle there.
Okay, so you're using the bike path space as opposed to what we think of as autonomous cars would be out in the car lane. This gives you what, more flexibility and more safety?
Yeah, I think ultimately, you know, safety is, I think, one of the biggest issues with autonomous vehicles. And so we're, you know, riding, again, along the side of the road where a bike would be. But what that allows us to do is go a little bit slower. And so it's safe to go 10 or 12 miles an hour with a bike. It's probably less safe or probably less convenient to go 10 or 12 miles an hour in the middle of the road. And so one of the beautiful things about this is that in the same way that cars can pass bikes, they can pass this vehicle. And even other bikes can pass this vehicle. So we spend a lot of time trying to be good road citizens. But when you go 10 miles an hour, one of the big wins is that you can stop a lot quicker. So we can stop in about 5 feet, which means that ultimately we can make sure that the vehicle is always safe when we're driving it autonomously on the streets.
And I know that you have been making robots since like 2003. And they haven't cracked the commercial everyday life yet, have they?
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to build this company. I've been building robots for almost 20 years. And, you know, while we've made some amazing robots and many other people in robotics have done amazing things, you know, I want everybody to be able to have their life touched by a robot and get to interact and hopefully have things made better, safer, and faster with robots in their day-to-day lives.
So does someone need to monitor Rev1 at this point, like back at the office, or how is it working?
Again, right now, safety is the number one priority. So we have somebody behind the vehicle on a bicycle with an emergency stop in case anything goes wrong.
Because you're in beta testing, right?
We're in beta testing, yeah. Exactly. And then we have another person back at headquarters that watches over the vehicle, again, remotely, and can take over control at any point in time. So there's really two safety checks. In the long term, we envision that there will always be somebody back at headquarters, at least watching over a few vehicles to make sure that, you know, things like emergency vehicles, any kind of crazy things that can happen out on the road, we can handle. But the safety cyclist will probably get scaled back, and we'll probably have the vehicles out there alone with remote monitoring, hopefully soon.
Accidents can happen. You know, roads are roads. What are you factoring in as far as the possibility or what the cost might be of some kind of an accident?
Yeah. So we, again, safety is critically, we're critically focused on safety. And so thinking about what would happen if something bad happened is always front of mind. And so by building a vehicle that's really, really light, what we're really focusing on is making sure that we don't hurt anyone else. Mm-hmm. Turns out that we don't really care if your burrito gets damaged. And so we're building a vehicle that if it got hit, it would crumple. And that if it bumped into anything, which we hope it never does, it would damage itself essentially before doing any damage to anything else. And so we've been thinking a lot about making sure that unlike with a full-size car, you don't need to protect the cargo. And so you can make a thing that is a lot lighter and softer and really deals with running into something in a much different way than a car would.
All right. Tell me how a couple tricky situations I'm wondering about. Left turns. Mm-hmm. And pedestrian zebra crossings.
Yep.
So how does Rev1 handle those?
So those are the hardest things for autonomous vehicles. And so, in fact, we've been really lucky that with remote operation, we're able to safely navigate those just the same way you would with a human driver. So there's somebody back home that can see and understand the zebra crossing and all the subtleties around is somebody coming out, just as you would as a real driver in your car. And so that's enabled us to kind of get around some of these challenges that have been really hard for even full-size cars with companies like Waymo and Cruise and that are spending billions of dollars.
Yeah. So, and this is something that is, I don't want to say cheap, but it is it's an affordable kind of.
Yeah. So keeping the cost of the vehicle low is really important to make the unit economics work. And so to deliver food that doesn't cost very much, it's actually important to make sure you use something inexpensive. And not just in terms of inexpensive. So the vehicle itself has a bill of materials around $4,000. But the other part of this is thinking about the efficiency and use of resources. So if you think about the way Uber Eats or Grubhub work right now, they use a car that weighs 4,000 pounds and burns fossil fuel to carry something that weighs 4 pounds, like maybe your burrito. And so it ends up that not being an effective use of things that we want to maintain, like greenhouse gases, fuel use, all those kind of things.
So tell us how you're doing the beta testing. Are you doing food deliveries? Are you working with restaurants?
Yeah, so we have two restaurant partners right now in Ann Arbor. So we have Miss Kim and then Belly Deli. And they've been great. We didn't pick two Asian fusion restaurants intentionally, but we ended up with two, and they've been amazing partners helping us test all of this. But we're doing end-to-end deliveries now, so we have people ordering, the food gets picked up, and then it's going to their homes. And so we're doing a handful of deliveries every day with each vehicle. And the restaurants have been great, helping us iron out a lot of the challenges that are different about what it is like to have a human do this versus a robot. One of the big things that sort of was not intuitive, but we probably could have predicted, is making sure that the human process of somebody coming out and interfacing with the vehicle is smooth. And so we're working to give better information about where the vehicle is. And so right now, it's going to send you not just that it's arrived, but also a specific location as to where it is, and even a photo from its camera so you can see on your street where it's sitting. And then you come outside and it has a code, and then you pop the code in and the door actually pops open just like a trunk would, and then you take your food out.
Then you take your food.
Yeah.
So how long do you think it'll take to move past beta and really ramp up this business?
So we have a plan to expand here in Michigan over the next 18 months, but also to be in two additional cities. And so I'm hoping this winter that, in fact, we will be able to open up to a much wider audience here in Ann Arbor and then begin to expand to additional cities. So over the next couple of weeks, we're going to go from a pilot group of probably around 20 to probably a group of around a couple hundred, and then keep growing from there. So we're really limited by the number of robots right now, and so we're trying to build more as fast as we can.
Matt Johnson Robertson, co-founder and CEO of Refraction AI. It's the company making Rev1. He's also a robotics professor at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The idea of urgent care is a familiar one, a less expensive, more accessible way to see a doctor for illness or injuries instead of going to the emergency room. Well, Pine Rest Christian Mental Health Services has taken that urgent care idea and applied it to mental health problems. Its urgent care center opened last spring, the first of its kind in West Michigan. And in just the first 6 months, the Pine Rest Urgent Care Center has helped some 3,000 people who are experiencing a mental health crisis. Megan Zambiasi is the director of the Pine Rest Christian Mental Health Services Psychiatric Urgent Care Center, and she's with us now from Grand Rapids. So Megan, Pine Rest has a psychiatric hospital. Tell us, what does this urgent care center offer people that the hospital and routine outpatient care don't or can't?
One of the things that we really wanted to do is to try to get the in-between space between outpatient, where people might wait for, you know, a few weeks or a couple of months even to see a psychiatrist if they needed an evaluation. Or the alternative was typically a higher level of care, which might be going into a partial hospital program or a inpatient stay. And so the urgent care allows people who are having symptoms today to come in and be assessed and get started with treatment if they don't need to experience a higher level of care.
Megan, how unique is this urgent care center, what you're doing there?
You know, we think we're very unique, actually, at least. There aren't very many urgent cares quite like this anywhere in the country, much less in Michigan, especially because we're a private nonprofit organization. There are crisis centers that are certainly available, usually through community mental health agencies, and those certainly have been operating for quite some time. But the thing that's really unique about us is that we actually have psychiatric providers on staff who do the assessment right here. In our community, we had heard that that was the gap in care that was really needed.
What kinds of things, Megan, are people going through when they come to the urgent care center?
You know, it's a variety of things. We've seen people certainly who have been experiencing a lot of symptoms of depression and anxiety. Those are probably our most common reasons that people are coming to see us. Their symptoms have become pretty overwhelming, and they're having trouble functioning on a daily basis. But we also see people for other concerns, people who are struggling with substance use disorders or who maybe have had a family crisis or something sudden happened, and they really are experiencing unbearable symptoms and need help.
So I'm a patient and I get myself to Pine Rest Urgent Care Center. Then what happens? What do I get in psychiatric urgent care?
And, you know, it's a lot like a medical urgent care in some ways. You come in and we check you in, ask you why you're here and what kinds of things you might be able to help with. You'll see a medical assistant to begin with who will take your vital signs and ask if you've been on other medications and get some medical history. And we also have you see a social worker who will come in and ask more details about what things might also be happening in your life that may have been contributing to the symptoms you're experiencing today. And then last, we have you see an advanced practice professional. So that would be a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant or a psychiatrist who will assess you and see what we think your next steps in treatment should be.
And typically, what might that look like?
For next steps in treatment, most of the people coming in to see us are going out to outpatient levels of care. So about 80% of the people that come in to see us actually are going to go back out and into the community and be connected with somebody who can see them, probably usually for therapy, and also to prescribe medication if that was necessary. And there, 20% of people, as they come in, actually do have symptoms that are pretty significant, and they may need a little more attention. So we want to get to them sooner, and then we'll refer them to that right level of care when they're right there in the urgent care with us.
Can people be referred to the hospital if needs be?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. If it seems like that's the most appropriate step, we can take care of that right then.
And then after I go home, after my day, then what? How do you make sure people continue getting the care they need?
Right. Well, you know, one of the biggest challenges, of course, is always trying to find connections for people out in their communities. And we've been seeing people from all over. I mean, most are coming from our surrounding area, but many are coming from counties that are pretty far away. So our staff have worked really hard to try to connect people as best as we can with those resources in their community. And in the meantime, you know, if there are other gaps, we have other ways to try to help people get what they need until they're waiting for that next appointment.
Megan, what are some of the most surprising things that you've seen in the nearly 7 months since the Urgent Care Center opened? I mean, what has really stuck with you?
Oh, goodness. We've been learning a lot, for sure, from the people that have come to see us. But one thing I think that has surprised us for sure is the age of the people that have come in. We didn't really know what to anticipate, but we found that a good chunk of the people that are coming through our doors are younger than we normally see in our outpatient appointments or even in our inpatient units. So we're getting a lot of young adults, so between the ages of 18 and 36, and many of them are people who have never come for care before. So seeing the urgent care is available has made it easier for them to access what they needed. And that's been really rewarding for our staff to feel like we're getting people right when they need us most and maybe avoiding more expensive levels of care down the road.
And I know you're serving adults aged 18 to 65. Do you have any plans to expand the service to children? I'm thinking of parents where a child is having some kind of a mental health crisis, school sends them home, and you've got this child, and you call the psychiatrist, and there's an appointment in 3 weeks.
Right. You know, our community has been asking us for that actually ever since we opened. So that's been their most common question. And we definitely hear that. And we are interested in doing that. There are, of course, lots of different things that children and adolescents need clinically that are different from adults even. And so we're exploring that right now to see what we might be able to do. We want to be able to provide the care well and to do it safely, which will include, you know, doing a lot of recruiting for the right staff and all those things. So that we're very interested that that'll be further down the road.
So as you alluded to, you have patients coming from a big number of counties in Michigan. So why are there not more urgent care centers like yours for mental health issues?
You know, I think that's a great question. We certainly have had a lot of interest from all over Michigan, actually, organizations that have contacted us since we opened and wanted to know more detail because they are interested in maybe starting something up in their community. I think one of the things that Pine Rest has that has really helped us to do this is that we have a lot of psychiatric staff already. So we have resources in that way, and we felt like this is a space where we could share those. And we wanted to be able to do that as quickly as possible. So that's why we decided we'd start with adults. We'd start in Kent County. We'd do what we could where we had kind of a critical mass of those important professionals to provide the service. But I think other places throughout the state that have that kind of resource would probably be able to run a similar model and do that successfully.
Is this a, for lack of a better term, Megan, is this a Band-Aid fix for the larger problem of the fact that in Michigan we have a shortage of mental health professionals, especially psychiatrists?
Right. I think I'm not sure if it's a Band-Aid as much as it's a solution that kind of lands in that in-between space. And, when I've talked to people who work in medical surgical facilities and have urgent care, of course, they've had urgent care for medical reasons for 30-plus years in most communities, we found that most of us have learned how to use those, right? If we've got a sore throat and we can't get to work today or whatnot and we can't get into our doctor, that's had a really good place. So I think it has in a continuum of services, it definitely would always have a place because people are going to continue to need care right when they need it. But does it solve long-term, the question of do we have enough providers? No. I think we obviously are needing to increase the number of people that are able to see folks on a regular basis outpatient as well.
Megan Zambiasi directs the Pine Rest Christian Mental Health Services Psychiatric Urgent Care Center. It is in Grand Rapids, the first of its kind in West Michigan. We want to thank you for speaking with us, Megan.
Oh, thank you so much.
When it comes to issues of race and identity, kids can teach us a lot about how to be a better human. On the final episode of Michigan Radio's podcast, Same, Same, Different, host Bryce Huffman talks to two moms. One is entrepreneur and LGBTQ activist Jody Patterson. She told this story about how her kids have helped her to see the world differently.
Their grandmother on their father's side is a white woman. And one day, just casually speaking, I said, oh, and grandma being a white woman. And they said, what? Grandma's white? What are you talking about? And I said, yeah, of course, grandma, white. She's from Canada. She's a white woman. And this is a woman who doesn't look mixed or ethnic there's no color to her skin, no color to her hair. You would not be confused. And yet, and still, they didn't know she was white. And they said, it cannot be. I mean, grandma can't be white. She's the color of my foot, which was also such a strange comment. But I think what they were saying was that if I'm black, and I know I'm black, and if our family is black, and if mama's black and daddy's black, then everyone in the family must be black because we are of one family. And so they weren't seeing color, for sure. And they weren't noticing, because my children are different colors, but they were thinking community and family, and since I'm central and I'm black, everyone in my family must be black too. And that was the first time I thought, wow, this concept of other pops up sometimes, and then other times it has no relevance.
You can hear all the Same, Same, Different episodes and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you listen. After the break, what are prisons for? We kick off our week-long series, Life on the Inside. That's next here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan prisons cost taxpayers $2 billion a year. Yet what happens behind prison walls is out of sight, often out of mind. All week, we're going to take a closer look at Michigan's prisons in a series we call Life on the Inside. Last month, the Stateside team gained unprecedented access to one of those prisons, Lakeland Correctional Facility in Coldwater. We'll hear stories from inmates later in the week, but we kick off the series by asking a fundamental question. Just what are prisons for? Heather Ann Thompson is a University of Michigan historian. She was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for her book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. She sat down with Stateside's Lester Graham.
Let's get down to some really basic questions. What is the purpose of a prison?
Well, that's the fundamental question. And I think that Americans are still battling over what the answer is. I think that most people think that at some core level, it's about returning people to society better than when they went in. But sometimes the vengeance feeling gets in the way and we get a very mixed message in the way we run our prisons.
When someone is sent to prison, it's in part to separate them to keep the public safe. It's in part to help them acquire some life skills, as you said, education or treatment to help them when they get out. And many people think prison is a place of punishment. What should it be?
Well, it's interesting because actually, legally and in terms of the way our history is unfolded, it is actually not meant to itself be a place of punishment. Prisons, the punishment itself is the removal from society. And in fact, we as a society actually have obligations to people that are in prisons because they're effectively under state or federal care. And so, ironically, if people hope that prisons are a place that will pile on punishment. That's not their intention. But we definitely have absorbed that ethos, and we don't realize quite how far we've gotten from the mark of what prisons are intended to do until we travel, you know, outside of the U.S. and see the way that other people are doing it, or even visit some of our history books to see how much more punitive being inside of prisons are today than they used to be.
There are victims of crimes. Their lives are sometimes struggles just to deal with the damage that's been done to them, whether it's physical damage or mental trauma. They don't always get the kind of care and chance to rebuild their lives that their assailant is given in prison. So how fair is that to the victims or the victims' families?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And in fact, when we think about criminal justice policy, it is essential that we think about a holistic approach. That is to say that everybody who is involved in a given incident, a terrible incident, needs to have care. And that means that people who have been the victims, for example, of an assault or the perpetrators of that assault are all there for very much in need of care, because we want to make sure that the person who's been victimized is repaired and gets heard and feels that some measure of justice has been done. But we also want to make sure that the person who's perpetrated that offense has heard them, has not been left to imagine that it didn't matter. Or also, frankly, we need to find out why they did it. We need to figure out why they did it so that they don't do it again. So unfortunately, as much as we want this to be a simple solution, it isn't. And in fact, the countries that do criminal justice more humanely actually do victims' rights more humanely, too. They take victims very seriously, and they just lean much more heavily on the idea that people actually don't feel better in the long run by making someone else feel worse. They feel better when they're heard.
But there is great outrage when some of these people in prison are guilty of heinous crimes, appalling things. So why should society be concerned about making life decent for them in prison?
Well, it's not a matter of whether it's decent or whether it's barbaric in terms of what the public thinks. That's actually a matter of law. And just because someone is convicted of a crime or someone does time, that does not mean they check their human rights or their civil rights at the door. Now, there's a far cry from that premise, which is, in fact, the law and the way that the system is actually meant to be set up, and the way people feel about it. And I think usually people feel most resentful about a prison system when they feel that somehow someone is getting something inside of it that someone on the outside isn't. The reality is that's rarely the case. These places are hardly country clubs. In fact, they're so barbaric that when the public actually sees what kind of justice is done in their name, they feel very discomforted by it. They actually are not very satisfied with what they see. And they're also troubled when they realize that so many of the people inside, in fact, the vast majority of the people inside, are not just simply someone who's committed a harm. They're actually someone who's also been victimized time and again. And that is why we have to have a system that protects victims from the beginning so that they also are not left alone to be damaged and then go on to become perpetrators themselves.
If you were to build a prison, a system, what would it include?
Well, it's interesting because I have been asked that question a lot. I teach this subject. I spend time in prisons in the U.S., and I had never really had to see what it might look like somewhere else until I actually recently just had the opportunity to visit prisons both in Finland and in Norway. And it was just surreal. I mean, I really invite a delegation of Michigan legislators to make this trip again with me, because it was so eye-opening to see that you could, in fact, achieve people's sense of taking responsibility. You could, in fact, make victims feel heard. You could, in fact, create a society where people actually returned to their families healthier and thus better for the broader community and for their children in for their partners when they get out than when they went in. And since what we're really talking about is wanting a system that achieves public safety, I got to see what that looks like. And it's quite startling, but it's also remarkable how doable it is once we abandon the idea that vengeance gets us what we want, even while we can certainly understand the impulse towards it. It just does not get us what we want in terms of public safety or feeling heard.
Give us a small example of what you saw that was so surprising.
Well, it was really remarkable. I mean, from the top brass on down, the question that you began this segment with was the question that they start with, which is, what is the purpose of prison? And they answer that question very, very clearly, which is to make society safer and to make neighborhoods more whole and to make families repaired. And when that is where you start, you do all kinds of things. Like, for example, you understand that when someone comes in, they will eventually come home. So you want to make sure that they don't come home less educated, for example, than they went in, because then they'll be more likely to commit harm. You want to make sure that they have kept their family relations intact so that they have a place to come back to rather than be an outcast in society and therefore hostile to society. And so, everything from a more humane visiting center for the children that visit their incarcerated parents to actual vocational training to actual education so people can become, you know, better participants in the society they return to. I mean, it's all there. And this is not a society that forgives heinous crimes lightly. It is a society that understands that public safety is the goal.
You are listening to Stateside. I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Heather Ann Thompson about the purpose of prisons. This series began when the Stateside team went to Lakeland Correctional Facility in Coldwater, Michigan. At that prison, about 44% of the population is made up of lifers, and a lot of them are older. There's a geriatric center there. But the question came up, how can the prison provide purpose and meaning for someone who's not going to get out, who's sentenced to life in prison?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And the answer is it is incredibly difficult to imagine that. I mean, for starters, we can do some basic things, like we don't continue to punish and torture people who are never, ever going to get out in the United States. I mean, there is such a diminishing returns when we do that. We end up having more old age prisons in our country than any other country on the planet. It's really, again, counterproductive to the broader society. But we really need to investigate this whole idea of a life sentence. No country hands out life sentences the way that we do, and yet they have much better public safety indices. And so that tells us something. I mean, we really need a more scientifically informed, empirically logical approach to criminal justice. So life sentences themselves are not something that other countries are comfortable with for exactly that reason. They believe that we need incentives. They believe that people actually are never the same person at age, 20 as they are at age 50, that everyone has the capacity to learn from their errors and to grow as a person. And to stimulate that capacity to, inform it is important for all of us. And let me just really stress that. So everybody that goes inside is a member of a family and a member of a community. And so when we make them better, the fallout from that is exponential on the outside as well. And that's the kind of the missing piece of the puzzle that we seem to have forgotten in our quest for vengeance.
Let me challenge that just a little bit. I was talking to one of the older lifers, and he looked at me with a pretty cold stare and said, "I am a bad man." And we went on and continued our conversation, and he basically was saying, "I should never be released." And if you've got somebody in who feels like they've done something so horrible and that they could do it again, shouldn't they be sentenced to life?
Well, of course, there's all kinds of, what we call sort of the fringe stories, which is to say that people either who have designated themselves as unredeemable, in small part because they have been, in the system for so long and have kind of absorbed that ethos so deeply, or, those fringe cases where we always go immediately to, the serial killers or the most extreme cases. And certainly every society has to deal with severely damaged human beings. And they may or they may not return to society easily or quickly or even without enormous preparation and, consideration. So it isn't that everyone automatically gets out, but it certainly is the case that we have life sentences handed out like candy in this country. So many people are serving life sentences for drug offenses when they were in their teens and in their 20s. We, Michigan, sentenced more children to life sentences than any other state than Pennsylvania. And the idea that we as a society don't believe, for example, that someone who's 13 years old is a different person by the time they are 20 years old or 30 years old really is not honest about their own development. And frankly, it flies in the face of science.
The prison population in Michigan is going down, and the state has been closing some prisons, but it's still a huge amount of money. There have been attempts to try to save money by going to private food services and private health care providers. What do you think of those efforts overall to save money when we're talking about incarcerating people?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it is such, as they say, bass ackwards approach to criminal justice. We know for a fact that in the United States of America, for all of our history, our incarceration rates remained relatively stable and relatively low. And in fact, we know that there is no correlation between super high prison rates and this public safety indices, except for negatively correlated. In other words, intensely incarcerated populations tend to be less safe. So what that tells us is that if we're trying to save money by privatizing rather than save money by rethinking our sentencing policy, that we are, again, just embarking on a fool's errand. It does not make sense to privatize because that simply puts another incentive to lock people up for longer. And it's not just a pie-in-the-sky claim. It actually plays out in real time. Our state legislators get lobbied. Our federal legislators get lobbied by private companies who are making a lot of money off of criminal justice, who don't want to see prison sentences reduced, and they don't want to see prisons closed. So we have just injected a profit motive into a whole system of human misery. And that just, it doesn't make sense. I frankly think it's immoral. And notably, we don't have to do it because we have an entire legacy of American history to look back on and see that we can have lower prison rates and not get more crime.
You took a deep dive into a certain period of incarceration in Blood in the Water, your book. Have we seen changes and improvements since that Attica prison uprising in 1971?
Well, there's tremendous ironies. You know, on the eve of Attica, we were actually, as a nation, beginning to decarcerate. We were reducing prison populations. We actually believed, Americans, when they were polled, believed that prisoners had basic human rights. The law reflected a greater humanization of conditions on the inside. And Attica is really tragic because it was an uprising to improve conditions more. I mean, the conditions there remain terrible. But because of lies told about that particular event by the part of state officials, and because in general there was such a backlash to the civil rights ethos, we actually built the prisons, you know, the way that we see them today, we built them in the wake of that moment. Prisons got more inhumane in so many places as a backlash. So we're really dealing with prisons as sort of the backlash to the 60s. And I know many viewers and listeners will hear that and say, roll their eyes. You know, what do you mean? This is about crime. It's not about politics. Well, you know, the thing is, we actually have had numerous blue ribbon panels come together of all political persuasions and myriad different disciplines and studied this within an inch of its life. And there is no question that we began this massive war on crime for political reasons. And the crime rate actually waxed and waned in its wake. But we kept on building prisons and filling them.
You've researched prisons and prisoners in America for years. What hope do you have that state and federal prisons will do some of the things you want to see in a correction system, something more like your visits to the prisons in Norway and Finland?
Well, I you know, it's sometimes it feels hard to be optimistic when we see that we're continuing, for example, to talk about building a jail in Detroit, a youth jail. I mean, just completely out of step with what the science tells us and what we know historically. Same thing is true right now in New York. They're going to close Rikers Island, but they want to build four new jails. So in that sense, it feels very, very daunting to imagine a change. On the other hand, there's tremendous goodwill right now, for example, in the Michigan state legislature. There's tremendous activism on the ground. A lot more people who've served time on the inside are now home and advising us as to what really needs to happen, and people are finally listening. And frankly, we are doing more trips abroad. And once you see that it is possible, you kind of come back and you think, my God, how wrong have we gotten this? And so that's all happening too.
Where does Michigan rank nationally for quality of prisons and its correction system?
That's a tough question. On the one hand, it has had some very good marks for actually trying to take seriously things like expungement legislation, rolling back the impulse that we had for a very long time of denying, say, parole for children who'd been given life sentences. So on the one hand, we've got some good things to talk about. And on the other hand, we still remain the state with so many people. I mean, we have as many people in prison in Michigan as the entire country of Canada. And if that doesn't kind of give us pause when we know, for example, that Canada also has poverty and racial tensions and all of that, then you know, Michigan still has work to do.
Heather Ann Thompson is a professor at the University of Michigan. Her book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in History. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Tomorrow in our series, Life on the Inside, the director of the Michigan Department of Corrections will be here to offer her thoughts on what prisons are for. Meanwhile, you can get an exclusive look inside one of Michigan's prisons. Head to lakeland.michiganradio.org for revealing black and white photos of those who work there and those who call it home. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.